From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our relationships with it. I'm Chris Cherniak.
And I'm Claire Wiley. And our first guest this morning is Nathan Havey, co-founder of Stakeholder Business and writer and director of the film Beyond Zero, which takes us through a life-changing epiphany of a CEO of a global public company who embarks on a high-stakes quest to eliminate all negative environmental impacts by 2020. To succeed, they had to overcome deep skepticism, abandon the status quo, and ignite a new industrial revolution. Beyond Zero offers an inspirational roadmap for how business can reverse climate change.
Then our second guest this morning will be Dr. Catherine Hayhoe, a climate scientist, the chief scientist for the Nature Conservancy, and a professor in the Department of Political Science at Texas Tech University. She's also the author of the book Saving Us, a climate scientist's case for hope and healing in a divided world. Dr. Hayhoe has studied the climate for nearly four decades and says that climate change is a threat multiplier to human existence, taking the already known challenges of hunger, poverty, homelessness, and conflict and making them worse. We either accept the realities of a warming world and reduce our consumption of fossil fuels, or we learn from its consequences. Catherine Hayhoe in the second part of the show. Environmental awareness and education, that's what This Green Earth is all about.
And joining us in the first part of the show, I'm very excited about this, Chris, we have Nathan Havey, who is the writer and director of the film Beyond Zero and co-founder of Stakeholder Business. Thank you for joining us this morning, Nathan.
My pleasure to be here, Claire and Chris. Thanks for having me. Yeah.
Well, let's start first, Nathan, with a foundation of who you are and how you came to create this film, Beyond Zero.
Sure, thanks. I think the best way to introduce myself is to say that I've always been somebody who wanted to use my career to leave the world a little better than I found it. And I started thinking that that was going to be through the world of policy. So I, you know, went and worked in the U.S. Congress for a couple of years and then kind of got really frustrated with the pace of change and started casting about looking for a different way to use my career. And I encountered a book by Ray Anderson called The Confessions of a Radical Industrialist. And in that, he kind of lays out the case that business can actually be a very effective lever for change in the world. And I started to really study that, always really interested in Ray's story. And about 10 years later, there's kind of an alignment of circumstances that had me be able to take a shot at making the movie. And it's done really well.
Yes. Now, this film does take us into those inner workings of Interface, which is a flooring business. And it had a change of heart on how it operates. Can you kind of walk us through the overarching storyline of the film?
Absolutely. So, you know, Ray Anderson founded the company in 1974, and about 20 years later, they lost an order from a big customer in California because they didn't have a good answer for what it was they were doing for the environment. And Ray always took it real seriously. He had a quote that the next order is the next heartbeat for a company. And so it sort of sent him into a little bit of an existential crisis where he was asking his leadership team, you know, what do they mean we don't get it on the environment? What we comply with the law. What else is there? And so one thing leads to another, and he reads Paul Hawken's book, The Ecology of Commerce, and it shakes him to his core as Hawken kind of lays out the case for how all of the life support systems of the planet Earth are in decline. And he, as an engineer, connects the dots between sort of the unconscious externalities of basically the Industrial Revolution, the way that he built his company, and its consequences on the environment. And so he shocks his team on August 31st of 1994 by basically saying Interface is going to keep innovating until it becomes a restorative company. And nobody knows what the heck that means. There's no roadmap for it. They have no idea. The language for this stuff isn't really even invented yet in 1994, but he just is relentless. And, you know, about 25 years later, Interface is recognized as one of the most sustainable companies in the world. And they made the transformation profitably. And so what the case really does is it gives us a roadmap for what all business needs to do if we're going to be able to kind of get in right relationship with the life support systems of Earth.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I'm sure in that moment in 1994, there were probably a lot of heads turned of what is this person doing? And it's this kind of birth of this conscious capitalism. Can you define what that means, conscious capitalism? And maybe in that moment, he was hit with that and what that reaction might have been.
Absolutely. And so you are exactly right. There's a scene early in the movie where he goes to a big kind of investor conference, and the CFO tells the story of Ray grabbing the, you know, at that point it was a 35 millimeter slide tray. And he takes the tray away from the CFO, and you know the tray is all loaded up with the financial performance numbers and, you know, market share and all that stuff that you would do in traditional business. And he grabs the tray and goes up to the stage and just sets it down for effect on the podium and proceeds to give a speech about how Mother Earth is in trouble. And, you know, everybody has no idea what's going on. People thought that maybe he was diagnosed with a terminal illness and was trying to get right with God before he died. The stock fell, their largest shareholder sold. And so it was not easy. It was something that they really had to learn what the heck this stuff was. And they learned a lot of it by making a lot of mistakes. But as you say, it is one of the early examples, along with Patagonia and Ben and Jerry's and a few others, of this notion that there is not a trade-off between sort of the profit maximization and making money for shareholders that you know Milton Friedman famously said is the only social purpose for business. There's not a trade-off between that and actually aligning the systems, the business model itself, with creating positive impacts for social and environmental sustainability. And that goes by a number of different names. You know, the benefit corporation movement is really chasing that. Conscious capitalism is after it. And then the company that I co-founded with my partners, Stakeholder Business, is really trying to teach business leaders exactly what that is. And the one important distinction that I'll say is that this is not philanthropy-based corporate social responsibility. It's not giving back. It's not sort of the business is over here and we've got some do-good initiatives over there. It's really aligning the way the business does its business with doing the things that are socially and environmentally positive in the world.
I think it's really interesting going back to what you said early on that initially when Ray approached his staff and said, we're going to make radical change here with respect to our environmental awareness and mindfulness, et cetera, and processes, their response was, wait a minute, we do abide by all the rules and regulations that are required of us, whether they're local or state or federal. Why do we have to go, you know, beyond that? Because isn't that going to cost us money? So I know you've alluded to it already, but the employees pushed back, I'm certain. How did he go about winning them over eventually?
There's sort of two major things here. And I think this is really instructive for any other business leader that is trying to do something similar, anytime you try to, Ray's quote was, abandon the comforts of the status quo. There's some entropy there, and so it takes a lot of energy. And so Ray just made sure that every speech he gave was essentially a masterclass on basic ecology, on understanding the way that the life support systems of Earth function, and the way that business negatively impacts those if it's kind of done in the normal unconscious way. And so that was one piece of it. But there's another major turning point that happens in the company, and this is another great scene in the film. It was about 3 years into the journey in 1997. It was the 25th anniversary of the company, and they had booked this huge party to bring in folks from all around the world to go to the Grand Wailea Resort in Maui. And so the company has just established this dream team of environmental luminaries to try to really push them forward and advise them. And when they say that they're doing this party in like the most unsustainable way possible, all of the luminaries say, this is no, don't just don't go, just cancel the thing. But they'd already booked the entire hotel. And so it's this major sort of turning point where they say, Ray says, I need to make this an opportunity instead of a liability. And so what they essentially did is they were able, because they had booked the whole hotel, to take over the operations, and they made it a kind of living experiment for a week, where they started tracking the waste, the water use, the energy use, all the environmental metrics they could. And then they would ask people to just do small behavioral changes that wouldn't compromise their experience, but would have a dramatic impact on the overall environmental impact of that hotel. And by the end of the week, they sort of reveal what they had been able to do. And it was this, anybody that was there will tell you it was a turning point in their life. Mm-hmm. It was this massively powerful thing that they experienced together. And they had, like, John Denver was there, you know, there's a whole bunch of really neat entertainers, but it was this moment where people got it at a deep visceral level. And it was really the turning point in the culture where after that, everybody sort of on a personal level realized this is something that we have to do, not just for the company, not just for Ray, but for us, for our families, for what became known as tomorrow's child, the unborn future generations who we are borrowing the future from.
And I find this really interesting because I picture it as this very Jerry Maguire moment that is happening here. And it's kind of, though, this reverse buy-in because the CEO has already made this commitment. Right. And he's the one from the top
right.
that has this buy-in, and he's trying to get everyone else to follow when it seems generally it's working the other way, where you need to get the buy-in from the top.
I think that that's really right. There's this interesting thing. There's a great business professor named Rebecca Henderson. She's the author of the book, Reimagining Capitalism in a World on Fire. And she's done a ton of work with that exact dynamic that you're naming. And she has this really interesting thing where if you interview CEOs, they will largely tell you that they'd love to be more ambitious on this, but they don't feel like they've got the buy-in from their, you know, their senior executives and the balance of the culture in the company. But then if you interview workers on this, they say the same thing. They would love to be more ambitious on this, but they don't feel like they've got the buy-in from the CEO and the C-suite. And so, you know, I don't know exactly how we solve that other than I think that if people were to start to be more aggressive on this kind of stuff, they would actually be surprised with how much buy-in there is.
We are speaking this morning with Nathan Havey, co-founder of Stakeholder Business and writer and director of the film Beyond Zero, which will be screening this Thursday at the Jim Santee Auditorium with the Real Community film series that goes on with Park City Film. And that will be screening at 7 p.m. if you want to watch this film. We have heard rave reviews and you had called it a roadmap. What have you seen since this film has come out? Have you seen greater change in corporations? Have you seen other people taking that first step forward?
Yeah, I would say, you know, I would love to give the film credit for this, but I don't think that's quite it. The people that are kind of working in the sustainability space in business would tell you that the ground has shifted dramatically in the last 5 years, both in terms of the pressure that companies are feeling to really be ambitious about sustainability and the progress that we're making all around the world. You know, you see a lot of headlines, including this week with a, you know, Category 5 hurricane barreling towards Florida 2 weeks after one hit of, you know, these dire, you know, the Amazon River is drying up and all that. And that is happening. It's true. But the thing that we don't hear about a lot of times is the just breakneck pace of progress. You know, the U.S. and a lot of developing economies have already decoupled economic growth from increased carbon emissions. And the more that we learn how to do that stuff, the faster everybody else in the world can do it. Europe is absolutely leading on this. And so I think that in the past 5 years, the pace of change is approaching where we need it to be. Like, boy, we might be able to pull this thing off. And I think that there's a lot of folks that don't feel like it's possible. There's a lot of lack of hope. But I think when people see this film, and the big thing that, the film has done is it's been screened in, you know, 300 some universities around the world. It's on airplanes now, ironically, and it's been used in many, many very, very large companies all around the world to try to inspire the kind of ambition that Ray and Interface had. But the thing that it really does for people is that it gives them hope, because it shows them a viable roadmap for what this change needs to look like.
And I did hear you say, which I love this quote, that we are not on a doomsday clock, but in this decade, we are on an aspirational clock for change. Can you talk me through why this decade is so important in our world?
Many people have said it, but we are the first generation to feel the impacts of climate change, and we are the last generation that's going to have the ability to do anything about it. This decade, the one that we're in right now, we've got, I think it's 63 months left until the end of the decade. It will be decisive. The thing about it, though, is that racing to zero, racing to mitigate the harms, is something that even at the Maui conference for Interface, they said that's just not the right frame on this, because avoiding the worst parts of this is actually not the game. There is such incredible innovation that could be unlocked. There are so many phenomenal market opportunities. It's such a great business opportunity to get really, really into this. And the kind of economic progress, the kind of social development, I mean, there is such a huge upside, but you have to get, hence the title of the film, beyond zero. You have to stop looking at mitigating negative harms and start playing the game of maximizing the positive benefits. And when you're there, then it's not about how expensive is this going to be. It's about how great is it going to be, right? And so if we start playing that game, and we are, but that is the game to play. And so 63 more months, if we play that game in earnest, we could end the decade not just narrowly avoiding disaster, but we can welcome in a whole new epoch of human flourishing.
Just a couple minutes left, Nathan. 30 years since Ray's rejection, right? That moment of rejection and the epiphany that followed has Interface Industries been a success, and has it inspired other companies? Can you name some other companies that have been inspired by Interface?
Absolutely. It has been a success, first of all. They continue to be a global force in the flooring space. Mm-hmm. They continue to be a massive leader in innovation. Just one of the things where the film ends is them releasing a carbon negative carpet tile product and distributing that all over the world. And so it's something that actually sequesters carbon through its manufacture. So really, really cool stuff. And then, yeah, in terms of its influence, basically name it. Walmart had a massive environmental revolution in its company in the early 2000s by studying the Interface example. Nike has long studied them. BP even has studied what they're doing. So most major manufacturers are there. And then some of the innovations that Interface has come up with, it used to be considered impossible to actually create 100% recyclable nylon, which is one of the most energy intensive products in the world. And they did it. And so once they kind of cracked the nut on that, thanks to their supplier Aquafil, that's based in Italy, then it made it possible for everybody else. And so Gucci and Levi's jeans and, a whole bunch of other companies now are using that same fiber and taking huge bites out of their carbon footprint because of these innovations. And so there are these knock-on effects that Interface has created, but now many other companies are starting to do them too, that makes it easier for every company out there now to really chase that notion of getting beyond zero.
Okay.
Well, I'm so glad that our community is going to be able to see this film this Thursday at the Real Community Series. It's Beyond Zero. It's playing at the Jim Santee Auditorium at 7 p.m., and it is written, directed by Nathan Havey, who we have with us here. Nathan, thank you so much for being on our show. We have a million more questions,
sure,
but we do have to go. Where can people find more information about Stakeholder Business and the film and what you're doing? Where can they read more about that?
Absolutely. I just would invite folks to go to stakeholderbusiness.com, and you'll find links to the movie and to some other resources to help companies that really want to get after this. Thanks very much for having me, you guys. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. Thank you, Nathan.
Thanks for all that you have done to push this forward. We sure appreciate you, and we hope to have you on the show again sometime.
Yeah, you bet.
Would love it. Talk soon.
All right. We'll be speaking with Dr. Catherine Hayhoe. Among many titles and positions Dr. Hayhoe has, she is a climate scientist, the chief scientist for the Nature Conservancy, and a distinguished professor and the political science endowed chair in public policy and public law in the Department of Political Science at Texas Tech University. Mm-hmm. Catherine, thank you so much for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
Thank you for having me again.
One of the many questions we'll have, maybe we'll get to, is like, how did a climate scientist end up in the Department of Political Science? But maybe there are important connections there, and we can get to that down the road. But let's start with a little background on yourself. How did you become a climate scientist?
Well, I grew up in a home where my dad was a science teacher, so I had the perspective that who wouldn't want to understand why the sky is blue or why the grass is green or why polar bears have black skin. But I was planning to be an astronomer. In fact, I was almost finished my undergraduate degree in astronomy and physics, and I was already doing research looking at how galaxies cluster around quasars and other fascinating things you find out there in the universe when I needed an extra class to finish my undergrad degree. And so I looked around and there was this brand new class on climate change over in the geography department. I thought, well, that looks interesting. Why not take it? And at that time, I thought, as many of us still do today, that climate change was a future issue that environmentalists cared about and environmentalists would work on and environmentalists would fix for us and the rest of us could watch their documentaries and wish them well, so to speak. And I took that class and I was completely shocked to find out, first of all, that climate change is no longer a future issue. It's already affecting us here and now. And of course, we're speaking at a time when the extreme weather disasters are just coming so hard and fast that every week there's a new one on our news feed. The terrible flooding in Asheville and other parts of North Carolina and Tennessee. At the same time, we saw terrible flooding on the other side of the world in Nepal. The week before that, there was terrible flooding in Central Europe, and a massively strong typhoon closed down Shanghai and killed hundreds of people in Vietnam. So today, we can see even more clearly this is not a future issue, it's present. But what really changed my perspective was when I learned that climate change is an environmental issue, but it is not only an environmental issue. It also affects our food and our water. It affects the safety of our homes and our health. It affects the economy and supply chains and even civil conflict. It affects us all, but it doesn't affect us equally. Those who've done the least to contribute to the problem are the ones who bear the brunt of the impacts, and that's not fair. And so for me, that was really what made me decide to become a climate scientist, the sense that those who are most impacted have the least voice to advocate for change. And so I felt like I need to do everything I can with my voice and with the abilities and talents I have to try to make a difference. Because if we don't, you know, it isn't about saving the planet. It's really about saving us.
Right. And you talk about climate change as a quote unquote threat multiplier. I guess you allude to that when you say that climate change impacts us in many different ways, physically, chemically, biologically in a way, and public health, right? And I guess that's where the political aspects come in play too. It has multiple tentacles.
Climate change as a threat multiplier is a term that was actually created by the military.
Mm.
And so that's how seriously the military takes this.
Right.
So basically, if we have an issue, or even worse, a crisis we're dealing with, whether that crisis or that issue might be, it might be a crisis of poverty or hunger, people who don't have clean water to drink or don't have a safe place to live, or there's political instability, or there's refugee crises, or there's resource shortages, whatever the issue is, climate change is actively making it worse. So climate change is not a separate bucket, so to speak, in at the end of the row of all the buckets of things we care about and things we're trying to fix. Rather, climate change is the whole in every bucket. So no matter what it is you care about, whether it's, you know, that you love having snow on the mountains here in Utah, or you care about the health of your kids in the world that they're growing up in, or if you're a person of faith, as I am, who truly believes that we have a God-given responsibility to care for every living thing on this earth, whatever our motivation, whatever it is that we care about, it's gotten to the point now where climate change is the hole in the bucket. It's making everything we care about worse. It's putting our success in jeopardy. And if we don't patch that hole, we're not going to be able to fix anything else that's wrong with the world.
I have heard you say that each of us is the perfect person to care. And I love that because I hear you saying that the brunt of it is generally on the people that are not causing or disturbing our natural resources or our environment.
Yes, in fact, the numbers are pretty clear. The richest 1% of people in the world, and to be honest, the threshold of what counts as the richest 1% is quite low in our terms, but the richest 1% produce double the carbon pollution of the poorest 50%. Yet, if you look at the countries where people are most impacted by these extreme weather events that are being supersized by a changing climate, by the heat waves that are more dangerous, the floods that are stronger, the hurricanes and typhoons that are devastating more area. The countries most affected are some of the poorest countries in the world. And so there's this huge mismatch or imbalance in terms of who is making the decisions and who's responsible for the problem, and who has basically no ability to make decisions, but yet is bearing the brunt of those impacts. And really, that isn't fair.
Over the last few years, or five, six, 7 years, there's been more efforts to develop attribution, science, attribution-type science that looks at any given event, let's say the hurricane or flooding, and attempts to attribute at least the intensity of that storm or the size of that storm to climate change. What are your thoughts about that? And give us an example of, say, Hurricane Helene that just went through, you know, the Gulf and Appalachia. Is there a way to attribute climate change to the strength of that storm?
Absolutely. So what we call individual event attribution, which is the idea of, for an individual extreme weather event, how much worse did climate change make that one event? That's one of the most exciting and cutting edge areas in climate science today. So 20 years ago, if we had had a devastating flood or hurricane or storm or heat wave, and you had asked me how much of that was climate change, I or any other climate scientist would have said, well, we can't attribute any one event to a changing climate, but we know that over climate timescales of at least 20 years, we see that, you know, floods are getting more frequent, hurricanes are getting stronger, you know, whatever long-term trend it is that we see. But nowadays, thanks to powerful climate models that we run on, the most powerful supercomputers in the world, we can compare what a world looks like without this blanket of heat-trapping carbon pollution that we're wrapping around the planet that's causing it to warm, that's supersizing all our weather extremes. We can look at a planet that doesn't have that extra blanket and a planet that does. And when we compare those two planets and we look at what happened from a given event, we can actually put a number increasingly on how much more likely a heat wave or a flood or a storm was, and even how much worse it was in terms of how many more acres were burned by wildfire, or in the case of Hurricane Helene, how much more rain fell. So if you go to my threads or my LinkedIn or my Blue Sky account, you'll actually see that one of my recent posts is specifically about this. One of my colleagues, Mike Wehner at Lawrence Berkeley Labs in California, did a rapid attribution on Helene, and they found that more than 50% of the rain that fell during that catastrophic storm would not have happened if the same hurricane had occurred, you know, 100 years ago, as it probably would have, because, you know, we've always had hurricanes and floods and droughts and storms. But 50% more rain, and they also calculated that climate change made Hurricane Helene 20 times more likely. So it's like climate change is loading the weather dice against us, and our chances of rolling a double six or even a double seven these days is much higher than it was 50 or 100 years ago, and it's putting us all at risk.
Does that make the conversation about climate change to people that are remain skeptical about it easier to have? Because now you can say, I know, you know, Hurricane Helene was not caused by climate change, but it was, well, it was multiplied by climate change. Does attribution make conversations about climate a little more acceptable to those that are skeptical?
No, because we've always said that climate change was making these things worse. And those who are skeptical are not skeptical because they actually doubt the science. If they were, they'd also be skeptical of stoves, refrigerators, and airplanes because it's the same physics. And right. I haven't met anybody who would have put in that category. But what is changing is the frequency of these events. Mm. So back in the 1980s in the U.S., we had about $1 billion climate or weather disaster every 3 to 4 months. So about 3 a year. Mm-hmm. And then accounting for how the value of the dollar has changed over time, now we're up to 1 every 2 weeks. And as of last year, 9 out of 10 Americans had personally experienced or being affected by an extreme weather event. And 2/3 of them actually drew the connection between a changing climate and more frequent or more severe extreme weather. So what is changing and what is helping conversations is, rather than telling people things, this gives us an opportunity to ask people things, to ask them, hey, where are you from? Oh, were you there when the wildfire smoke blanketed the sky? Or were you there for those terrible floods? Or what was your summer like this year? And pretty soon people will be telling me, rather than me telling people, their personal experiences. And so then all we have to do is say, yeah, this is terrible. And I'm so sorry you were affected this way. You know, we see this happening all across the U.S. In fact, we see it happening around the world. And then often the next question they have is, well, what are we supposed to do about it? And that's exactly where we want the conversation to go, because those are where the real objections are. Most climate denial is simply solution aversion. I don't want to fix it. But if I say I don't want to fix the problem that's affecting people, that would make me a bad person. So instead, I'm going to say it's not real. But if we can figure out how to fix it and what we can do together, that's where I feel like the real movement can happen.
Let me reintroduce you. We're speaking with Dr. Catherine Hayhoe. She is a climate scientist, the chief scientist for the Nature Conservancy, and a professor in the Department of Political Science at Texas Tech University. Catherine, you're here in Salt Lake City this week. What brings you to town?
Well, I am here to speak at the Conservative Climate Summit, hosted in Provo this year, which I love because a thermometer is not blue or red. It doesn't give you a different answer depending on how you vote. And as we saw so tragically just recently, a hurricane does not knock on the door of your house and say, excuse me, who are you planning on voting for in the upcoming presidential election before right. it floods your entire house and destroys everything you have. Climate change affects us all. And we do need our politicians to be arguing because that's what politicians do best. But I want to see them arguing over who has the best solutions to climate change, because many of those solutions are inherently conservative. Mm-hmm. What is more conservative than conserving our natural resources, than increasing the efficiency at which we use our energy, than making sure that people have the resources they need and a safe place to live? And so I would love to see elected officials at every level arguing over who has the best solutions. So I'm hoping I'm going to hear a little bit of that here.
And when you talk about solutions, one of the things that we deal with here is clean energy. And that is a topic that you might tackle, I understand, as you talk about clean energy solutions and significantly here in Utah, what we're up against.
Yes. So the solutions come in three categories, basically. And the easiest way to understand them, in my opinion, is to think of the atmosphere like a swimming pool. So imagine an above-ground swimming pool like the one I grew up with when I was young, and my toes could just touch the ground. So the atmosphere is like that pool. And before the Industrial Revolution, it had just the right amount of heat-trapping gases that our toes could just touch the ground. Our planet was the perfect temperature for life. In fact, that's why civilization developed and thrived for thousands of years. But at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, we stuck a hose in the swimming pool. And we've been turning the hose up every year. And so the level of water in the pool, the level of heat-trapping gases in the atmosphere, is not only going up and up year after year, it's going up faster and faster. So the first thing we have to do is we have to turn off the hose. And in order to turn off the hose, there's no silver bullet, so to speak, but there's a lot of silver buckshot that if we put it all together, we have enough to turn off the hose. And at the top of the list of things that we can do to turn off the hose is actually efficiency. We are so wasteful with our energy that we waste 67% of the energy that we consume. And in fact, they've estimated that we could cut our carbon emissions half of what's needed by 2030 just through efficiency alone. And of course, we would save money through doing so. But of course, we also need to replace the old and frankly dirty ways of getting energy that served us well in the past, but now we know today are contributing to planet warming emissions. We need to replace those with clean sources of energy. And that includes the sun and the wind, but it also includes storage, because of course we know the sun doesn't always shine and the wind doesn't always blow. Mm-hmm. But then there's also exciting new developments in geothermal. There's hydroelectricity, there's tidal, there's lots of different ways to get our energy. And then we can also, and this is a lot of what the Nature Conservancy does, we can work with nature too, to ensure our agricultural lands are not producing carbon pollution, but rather taking it up. And then for the very, very last few drops at the end of the hose, we have the very expensive and very energy intensive technologies like carbon capture and storage for the very last few drops that we can't get rid of any other way. But there's two more categories of solutions. Our pool has a drain. And that drain is nature. And by investing in our nature, in forests, grasslands, coastal wetlands, and more, we can take carbon out of the atmosphere. At the Nature Conservancy, we've calculated we could take almost a third of the hose out of the atmosphere through making the drain bigger. And then, for many people, their toes don't touch the ground anymore. And so we also have to learn how to swim. That's building resilience and adapting to the changes that are already here today. So if we do all three of those things, turning off the hose, making the drain bigger, and learning how to swim, that's the pathway to a better future for us all.
Right, because you kind of, in your bio or so webpage, you paraphrase another gentleman who says the more mitigation we do, the less adaptation will be required and the less suffering there will be. So so those two things, and you reminded me while you were talking about that good news that came out of Britain last week, the fact that the last coal-powered power plant in Britain was closed. And so there's no longer any coal-fired power plants. And here, even here in Utah, a number of smaller coal-fired power plants have been shut down over the past few years. And a very large one is scheduled to be shut down next year, I believe. So there, even here in Utah, which has its, you know, wealth of coal and natural gas and some oil, there are efforts being made to reduce the carbon footprint here. And we have no shortage of sunshine and some wind and the prospects for geothermal. So we have a wealth of energy sources here that we can employ. And it'll be interesting to hear what kind of conversations there are that you have with the folks at the Conservative Climate Summit.
Yes, exactly. I'm excited too. Like I said, you know, there's no one silver bullet, but there's a lot of silver buckshot. And I feel like Utah has a lot of that right here at home.
And I love when you do use the word hope as well, because on this show, we talk a lot about some of the heavier things that we are facing due to the climate crisis. But if you don't look forward with hope or look forward with solutions, then it can be even heavier. In a quote, you said, hope may sound rosy, even easy, but it also is a choice one Utah can and must make.
These days, so many people feel like there is no hope. And so those who feel like there's nothing we can do about it, you know, don't want to act. And then often many people who are very worried, and in fact, 2/3 of people across the U.S. are already worried about this issue. They feel like hope is the sort of false hope where you just say, oh, I hope everything will be okay. Mm-hmm. And if that's all we do, it will not be. But real hope actually begins with recognizing that it is not okay, because mm-hmm. you don't need hope if everything's fine. You only need it when everything is not fine. And the more not fine it is, the more you need hope. And so I'm sorry to say we are rapidly heading in that direction. So we need more hope every day. But the hope begins by recognizing that it's bad and it's getting worse. but a better future is possible. And the path from where we are today to that better future, we have to lay out what that looks like and figure out how each of us can help move ourselves along that path. And that to me is the definition of hope. It is a very active, a very muscular, so to speak, a very disciplined activity. Yeah. I feel like some days I practice hope like it's an Olympic sport. I mean, I go out and I search for hopeful stories and I share them with my Talking Climate newsletter every week. And I post them online. And I always include information about what people, individuals can do to make a difference. Because it's one thing to feel like, okay, well, over there, they're putting up a wind farm. But what can I do in my personal life? We all need to feel like our hand is on that giant boulder too, pushing it down the hill faster and faster. Because action is integral to hope.
And that communication is so important around that. And I do appreciate that you put out so many points of communication that people can absorb and look for ways in which we all can make a difference in our own right.
So when I started talking with people quite a while ago now, almost 15 years ago about climate change, you know, speaking to women's groups or church groups or, you know, senior citizens home or community organization, pretty soon the most common question I was getting is, what can I do? And you know, 15 years ago, I was thinking, well, you know, I'm a climate scientist. I mean, I diagnose the problem, but, you know, I don't tell you how to fix it. Like, that's just not what I do. But obviously, that's a very incomplete approach, because if you go to a doctor and they diagnose that you have, you know, a certain an infection or a disease, and then imagine if you ask the doctor, what should I do? And the doctor's like, oh, I don't know. That's not what I do. You have to have answers. Mm. So I started looking around 15 years ago, and I said, well, you know, we have these carbon footprint calculators. Maybe we could calculate our personal carbon emissions and look at what we eat and what we drive and how we get around and how we heat and cool and power our homes. And I made changes in my personal life as well, because, you know, we can't just talk the talk. We got to walk the walk too. Mm-hmm. But then I calculated that if all of us who were worried, and again, 2/3 of us are, did everything we could, and make no mistake, often it is more difficult and it requires more effort, and sometimes it even costs more money to do the right thing. If we did everything we could to reduce our own emissions, I calculated that wouldn't even fix 20% of the problem. Hmm. So clearly there had to be something more. And so I started looking through data on social science, data on solutions, reading books about, you know, what are the most impactful actions that can be taken in society and in our individual lives. And through looking at public opinion data from the Yale Program on Climate Change Communication, I was struck very powerfully by a series of maps they had where they asked people, do you think climate change is real and are you worried? And most people said yes. And then they said, do you think climate change will affect people in the future, plants and animals, people who live far away? And everybody said yes. And then they said, do you think climate change will affect you? And the numbers dropped by a third. Mm-hmm. And then they said, do you ever talk about it or hear somebody else you know talk about it? And the numbers tanked. And I realized talking is so intuitive to us as humans that we just take it for granted. And we didn't realize that people are not having conversations about why this matters and what we can do. And of course, talking isn't enough to fix anything, but talking is the essential first step to fixing anything. Because how do humans do anything without communicating with each other? Mm-hmm. So when I was asked to do a TED Talk, like 2 years before the pandemic, I said, well, I want to do a TED Talk on the most important thing that we can do to fix climate change. And they're like, well, we already have TED Talks on changing your light bulbs and plug-in cars and plant-based diets. And I was like, no. We have to talk about how we're not having conversations about why this matters, not doom-filled conversations about dying polar bears and slowing ocean currents, but conversations about what's happening where I live to people or places or things I care about. So talking about the heart rather than the head, and then always bringing in the hands. What is being done in my community? What's being done in my city, my school, my place of work, my church, my family? What am I doing in my personal life? What's somebody else doing that maybe I could do too? We have to bring that into the conversation too. So if we can help people connect their head that's worried to their heart, why they care, to their hands, what they can do to make a difference, that's what I feel like could be the biggest catalyst for change.
So it's interesting that you recognize you know, a couple decades ago, that climate change was not a future problem. It is a problem of the present. Yet, based on that Yale survey, there are many people, like you say, although recognize that climate change is an issue, it still remains a future problem to them.
It does, but sadly, that is rapidly changing. And number one reason it's rapidly changing, I hate to say, is that the weather dice are getting loaded against us.
Yeah.
Nowadays, only 1 out of 10 people can truly say that they haven't been personally affected by extreme weather over the last few years. And I know as a scientist that the more of this carbon pollution we produce, the more coal, gas, and oil we burn, the more trees we cut down, the more unsustainable practices we use in our agriculture, the more of this we do, the worse it's going to get. And so there's no magic number. Like if we just, you know, if the world warms to 1.49 degrees, then we're okay. But if it passes with a 1.5 degree threshold, then we're going to hell in a handbasket. That's not the way it works. It's sort of like smoking cigarettes. You know, the more packs of cigarettes you smoke, the worse the impacts. And that's exactly what we see with our carbon pollution. The more of it we produce, the worse the impacts. And if we can already see these impacts today, unless we take serious action now, it's just going to get worse. That's the bad news. The good news is that as the science says, and this is literally the conclusion of the big giant intergovernmental panel on climate change reports that come out every 6 years, their conclusion is every action matters. Every bit of warming we avoid matters. What we do will determine our future. We have the power to act, and our future is truly in our hands.
Yeah, we like to say here in town that every meter matters in a way that whether it's your water meter or whether your gas meter or your natural gas meter or your electric meter, they all matter. They all play a role, and we can all do something about that. Although the one percenters can do a lot more than other 99, right?
Well, I think we are all realizing that sense of urgency to make these changes today, like you said, Catherine, that will affect us tomorrow. And if people want to learn more about you or follow your different points of communication, how would they do that?
Well, it's very easy to do. You just have to Google my name. And if you go to my Threads or my Instagram account, pinned to the very top is a list of the 6 most important things that individuals can do to make a difference based on the social science. And right at the top of the list is having conversations. I also have a weekly newsletter called Talking Climate that you can sign up for via email on my website, which is just my name, Catherine Hayhoe. You can sign up for at Substack at talkingclimate.ca. You can sign up for it at LinkedIn, or you could even sign up in the Instagram and Threads Talking Climate account. I recycle all across the web. And every week I share good news about climate solutions, not so good news about how climate change is affecting people and places and things we care about. And then I always share something practical that we can do together. And what I love is that we often feel like, well, I'm just one person, so what difference can I make? But, you know, when we do things together, we can make a huge difference. And a year and a half ago, actually almost 2 years ago, I spoke at the BYU Forum in Provo, Utah. And I talked about how, as a Christian, I truly believe that caring about God's creation, which includes people and other living things, it's a true expression of loving others and caring for others. And so in response, the students at BYU decided that they were going to have conversations about why climate change mattered and what they could do about it. So they started tracking the conversations. And pretty soon, within just a matter of a few months, they had had conversations on every continent of the world, including even somebody who was in Antarctica doing research from BYU. And as of today, they're up to 73,000 conversations that they have had. And it all started with one person saying, hey, why don't we talk about why this matters? So as individuals, we might feel like I'm just one person, but when we use our voice to connect with others, that is how we can power change.
Well, Dr. Catherine Hayhoe, we want to thank you so much for using your voice.
Absolutely.
To help us, to educate us and bring better, more insight into the challenges of climate change. And unfortunately, like you say, the potential consequences of not acting. So thank you again, Catherine, for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
Thank you for having me.